Hello, and welcome to Wargaming Recon. As always, I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. I want to wish you all a very wonderful, warm, sunny day out today. I'm recording this right after the Huzzah Convention held up in beautiful Portland, Maine, over the weekend of May 4th to May 6th, 2012. It's glorious weather out there today, and I hope when you're listening to today's episode that you are having wonderful weather as well. Maybe you're outside doing a little spray painting, priming your models, and just listening to a bit of the show as you get things all set so you can have a wonderful summer of historical wargaming. So on today's show, as you might have guessed, I want to talk about my recent trip to the Huzzah Historical Wargaming Convention held up in Portland, Maine. But first, I want to just give a little bit of, I guess you can call it a little bit of a monologue. You know, you watch shows like Letterman or Leno or Conan O'Brien or whatever, and they always come out, they do the little stick, and they're like, oh, I got a couple jokes and this and that or whatever. And here on the show, I'm usually like, hey, I'm so-and-so, and, you know, we get a great show for you, because usually I feel, actually always I feel that we have a great show for you. So I do that, and it gets kind of tiresome for a while. You're going to notice in today's episode, I'm doing this live. I'm doing this live in my home for a few friends who happen to be furry and very cuddly. I thought I'd try this out because of something recent that I had read. I wrote my previous week's column on trollitc.com, where I do a weekly column, usually about wargaming, but I get to talk about just about anything I want. And in my column, I wrote about the importance of podcasting and the importance of being true and loyal to one's listeners. That was kind of brought on because I had read a new book put out by Kevin Smith, who some of you may know from his work directing films like Clerks and Chasing Amy and things of that venue, but he's also written comic books and like all sorts of stuff. Now, whether you like him or hate him, you gotta admit that he has done something, and he's not someone who you might imagine would actually make anything out of himself. His new book is Tough Bleep, Life Advice from a Fat, Lazy Slob Who Did Good. And in it, there's a whole section where he talks about being a podcaster. He's very much into podcasting. He loves, you know, social media. He loves doing podcasts, so much so that he has created what he calls a Smodcast Network. And it's so named based off of an initial from his last name, an initial of one of his friends, Scott Mosier. You put the S and the M together, you get Smod, Smodcaster, Smodcasting Network. And he has a bunch of podcasts on there. Most of them are humorous kind of comedy sort of things that he does with friends of his and people in his life, his wife. I think his daughter's been on a few of them. But I have been in kind of a bit of a lull lately. You may have realized that the show before this, it took me quite a while to actually get it out to you guys. Every so often, you know, there's this absence of shows where I either get caught up in other projects. Right now I'm working on my Dead Hampton Revolution, so I'm doing all that sort of stuff. I might be reviewing things, or one of the things that keeps me going is hearing from all of you. And if I'm not getting feedback, you know, I'm putting this out there and I'm not getting anything back, so it feels like it goes into a black hole, as it were, this void. And so then I kind of get, oh, well, you know, I could do something else. Maybe I want to watch a TV show, or there's that book I always wanted to read, and next thing you know, a few weeks have gone by or a month has gone by and I haven't released a show. And I was kind of in that slump. So I was reading this book, and in it he talks about the importance for podcasters to do certain things. That, you know, we put out an episode, and if we say we're going to have new episodes, you know, once a month or weekly or whatever, that you, the listeners, expect us to adhere to that, that we're making a deal with you, basically. Our word is that we are going to release a show every so often, that we're going to talk about whatever, and that those of you who listen to the show expect us to release that. So if I say I'm going to give you a new episode every other week, twice a month, I need to make sure that no matter what, I get that episode out to you, that is as important as making sure that, you know, I go to work, that I do whatever stuff I have to do around my house, that it's one of my responsibilities and one of my commitments that not only do I look forward to, but one that I have to adhere to. And it's easy when you're in a slump to kind of let that go and sit by the side of the road and just kind of move on to what you do. And just eventually, you know, ignore it. And in my column, I had talked about how basically this show had started and stopped several times and that there were gaps of many, many months. I think at one point there was 6 months or more gap show in between new shows. And that basically the show kind of had died at multiple points because I lost interest or other things came up. And, you know, there's numerous reasons why it happens. But that I have to keep myself motivated in order to put out new episodes for you to listen to. I promised, you know, a new episode every other week, twice a month. I promised to keep them about an hour in length, that I have to stick with this. And Mr. Smith had also talked about that, you know, whether you have one person listening or you have 5 million people listening, it doesn't really matter, that you need to stay true to them because these people, you are the ones who spend the time, who invite me into your lives, and who listen to my show, so that I need to maintain the same quality to give you what I've promised to give you. I also need to stay true to myself and give what I think you want to listen to and what I want to talk about, because if I suddenly, say, lose interest in talking about a particular topic, and I'm just going on and continue to do that because that's what I've always done, then I'm going to feel that I'm not fully vested in it, and therefore it won't be as good as if it's something that I'm excited about and something that I'm really interested in. So you'll notice that I don't talk about Flames of War as much anymore. In way back in the beginning, I talked about Flames of War. I talked about Games Workshop, and those are entities that I'm just, the games I'm not really into as much anymore. I've switched gears, and the show has switched gears accordingly, so that now we've moved away from kind of the tourney mindset into more of an old school, meet new school, kind of casual gaming, wargaming sort of feel. And hopefully those of you who listen to the show, you like it, and that's why you listen to the show. And if you have other interests, I mean, there are other wonderful shows out there for you to listen to. I listen to many other shows. They're not all, you know, of this same type that what I do, but it all fits in together. So I think that as gamers, we can kind of, you know, listen to a show here, another show there, and they piece together and fill in all our little holes and gaps that make up our gaming world. Kevin Smith also had mentioned that, you know, it's important to stay true to the people who listen to our show, that, sure, you want to grow your audience so that you can reach more people, and who doesn't like to do that, but it shouldn't be about the numbers. You shouldn't be tracking every single time and saying, oh, I got one more person listening than I did last week. Let's see if I need to change things to get more people to listen. Hold your horses. What you're doing is good, because if it wasn't, people wouldn't be listening. So you need to continue with what you're doing, and spread the word, of course, so that other people who like what you're doing will listen. But you shouldn't change yourself to meet the perceived needs of those other people. So I want you to know that no matter when I might have a slump, or no matter if there's a gap or whatever, that I'm doing my best to try to stay true to my promise of giving you a new show twice a month, about an hour in length. I'm doing my best to try to get guests on here and to talk about things that I think are interesting, that I think you might think are interesting, and to give just my best performance, my most honest thoughts to you so that you can enjoy them in your own time. And I also want you to know that I love your feedback. So whenever you feel like getting in touch with me, please do. At the end of every show, I give you multiple ways to get in touch with me. But briefly, you can email me, cwfgamecast@wargamingforums.com. You can send me a tweet on Twitter. It's @cwfgamecast. You can go on Facebook, where we have a Facebook page, CWF Gamecast and Wargaming Recon. You can go on our blog, wargamingforums.com, and we put show notes on there. I have show notes for every single episode. Leave a comment on there. Leave a comment on another thing on there. Or if you want to head on over to trollitc.com, you'll be able to find my weekly column over there. You'll see all the stuff that I put up. I'm an editor over there, and you'll be able to see all the stuff that I put up. And feel free to leave comments on there. And you know, a lot of you know me in real life, or at least some of you anyway, so you know how to reach me by phone, in person, snail mail, text message, you know, whatever. I'm an accessible guy. I'm connected to social media, and I love all of it. I love hearing from all of you. So however you want to get in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you. So enough of that. At that point, I'm going to get off my soapbox and get into Huzzah Gaming Convention 2012. This is the third year that Huzzah has happened. I've been lucky enough to go to two of them, and as some of you who have listened to the show from last year, where I talked about Huzzah 2011, you'll know that I was informed about Huzzah by my gaming buddy, Adrian. And Adrian has been going all 3 years, and he said, you know what, John, there's this awesome gaming convention up in Maine. If you want to get into historicals and you want to see things done, really well done, and have a blast with a lot of guys who just love to have fun and who do a great job of both running a con and running games, that Huzzah's the thing to do. So my gorgeous wife, last year for our first wedding anniversary, agreed for us to go up to Huzzah to go and celebrate our anniversary up in beautiful Portland, Maine. And I split my time between gaming and spending time with my wife and had a blast. So this year, I asked her if we could do the same thing. And you know what? She had no problem with it. She loved it. She loves Portland. I love going up to Portland. So we did it again. And this time, I had registered for 3 games. I registered for First Battle of Sackett's Harbor 1812, which was a naval game using the Trafalgar rule set. It was run by Richard Clayton of Boston Trained Bands. I then also registered for Battle of Wurttemberg 1813, which was a game using the Black Powder rules, also run by Richard Clayton of Boston Trained Bands. And then the last game I had registered for was Conquest of Hankai. It's a homebrew system run by Mike Payne, and Mike has been doing this for numerous years. So I was looking forward to all of these games, and you know, we went down on Friday evening, well, Friday afternoon, I guess, and we got up there about early Friday evening. We like to go up Route 1. We live in Massachusetts, so my wife and I, you know, we drove up because it's scenic on Route 1, and you can stop at some cool places along the way. We love to stop at the Main Diner. If you're fans of, you know, the Food Network channel, they've been on things like Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives and other TV shows. They're won awards from Fandom Gourmet and stuff like that. So we stopped there, and I got what I love to get, which is lobster mac and cheese. I'm not a lobster kind of guy, but you know, when you go to Maine, there are 2 types of foods you really need to have. You need to have something that has Maine blueberries in it, and you need to have something that has Maine lobster in it. Like I said, I'm not a big lobster kind of guy, but when I had that last year, I loved it. I loved it so much that, you know, when my time comes to go and leave this world, I want that to be my last meal. It just is so good. So we had stopped there and had a wonderful lunch. My lobster mac and cheese was delicious, as always, and followed up with a fantastic piece of homemade blueberry pie. Love those Maine blueberries with a little bit of homemade vanilla ice cream. Put that with my wife, and then we moved on up and made it into Portland, where we had dinner the first night at the hotel. The hotel that houses the wonderful Huzzah Historical Gaming World Convention is a Fireside Inn and Suites in Portland, Maine. And this is a nice independent hotel. Their rates for the rooms, if you're going for the convention, they were about $79, $80 a night. And that gets you basically a king-size bed. And the room's pretty big. They're nice. You get a decent view of outside. They have both an indoor and an outdoor pool. The outdoor pool's gorgeous and was open this time of year. And they have a decent-sized space for the convention for gaming. The convention had taken over all of the ballrooms, I believe. And it's cool because they're all interconnected so that you can basically have it open and it's like one gigantic space. But it's not overwhelming. It still has this intimate kind of feel. So when we were there, you know, we just kind of hung out because it's a long drive from Massachusetts. So if you're going up Route 1, it's like 3.5 hours to go. And I mean, you could cut some time off by going on the highway the whole way. And there's some toll roads and stuff to go through. So it's up to you whether you want to go ahead and pay the fees for the tolls or not. But, you know, it's a long ride, so we just needed to hang out a little bit. But my first game, the first battle of Sackett's Harbor, was at 7 o'clock, so we had to eat. And we ate in the hotel restaurant, which, you know, it's not the best in the world, but we enjoy it. And it was kind of cool because as part of going to the convention, the hotel gave these vouchers where you could get a free drink or a free dessert as part of, you know, your meal because of attending the convention. So we had those, but we didn't use them. You know, my wife and I were both trying to watch what we eat. I'm on the Weight Watchers plan. And I didn't want to spend the requisite Weight Watchers points for dessert or whatever. So we just kind of kept it low-key, but it was really cool because while we were eating, you could see a lot of the other convention goers in the hotel having something to eat before the games began. And after dinner, you know, I had to go and get changed. I put on my Wargaming Recon t-shirt and got my Wargaming Recon business cards, headed down to the ballrooms, and I was, I think I was maybe a couple minutes early, but I thought I was going to be a little bit late. It was cutting it close. It got in, and the table was all set up, and Rich runs a great game. It's really what it is. I've never played a bad game that the Boston trained bands have organized. They're just a good group of guys. They do a fantastic job of setting everything up, of explaining the rules, of, you know, just putting everything together, and they do a great job of having a beautiful table to play on. All the models look wonderful. The terrain looks great. So for this, this was using Trafalgar, which is part of the Warhammer historical set of rules. This covers naval warfare. And I have been thinking about using this set of rules for the Deadhampton Revolution, for, you know, any sea battles. I haven't really, you know, worked out how things were going to go with that, but I thought, you know, this is my chance for me to go and try out the rules. I've heard tons about them, but I've never actually played with them. So I wanted to see, you know, what would I think about them? Would they be good? Would they be bad? Were there things I would want to change about it? I needed to get some firsthand experience with the rules. So in this, it takes place in 1812, you know, the War of 1812. And basically, there's two sides, the Americans and the British. So I was placed on the American side basically because in the Deadhampton Revolution, I'm one of the colonies which will be seceding away from my version of England. And Adrian was also playing the game, and he was going to be on the British side. And he was like, hey, you're on the wrong side, buddy. You got to get over there with those Americans. So I was playing with this guy named Alan, who was a really nice guy. He unfortunately thought the game was going to be the Second Battle of Sackett's Harbor. And that's a land-based game. So he was expecting it to be land-based, and we were trying to divide up the forces. And at first, you know, he thought he might take one of the ships and the fort. But then after a bit, he was like, how about you can be the commodore, you can take the ships. And he wanted to take the fort, and I think it was maybe a little bit closer to what he was expecting. So the Americans have this fort, and we have these two ships. One's a brig, and one's this kind of sloop. It's basically, it's not much bigger than a raft. And the goal for the British is they need to go and take over the fort, and then they need to capture the little sloop sort of ship. And it's John Paul Jones. It was a captured British ship, and that's why the British Navy wants it back, because, you know, those dang Americans captured one of our vessels, and we need to get it back for honor. So they wanted to take care of that. And if they could take out the American larger vessel, all the better, but not necessary. As you can guess by the name of the game, it takes place in a harbor. So the Americans are outnumbered by, I think it was like four or five British vessels to the two Americans. You know, they had a couple larger square-rigged ships. Most of them were smaller sloop sort of vessels. And in the Trafalgar rule set, it's pretty cool because basically, you're supposed to play with a lot smaller vessels. We were playing with, I think they were made by Old Glory. And I think they were maybe 25 mil or 28 mil scale ships. So, you know, decent size. And in Trafalgar, movement is in centimeters. But because we were using larger ships, we were using inches. So instead of moving, like, say, 12 centimeters, we were moving 12 inches or 14 or whatever. And in the rules for Trafalgar, you basically, you decide who goes first by who is closest to the wind, and the wind can change. So you roll a die to see if the weather changes, and if so, you could have a change in intensity of wind, you can have a change in direction. So in the game, the wind started off in a certain direction, and Rich was able to keep track of this because he had this little compass. And I believe Gale Force 9 makes some really nice ones that you could use, and in the rules, you know, if the wind changes, it'll be like, oh, you move it 1 point clockwise or 1 point anti-clockwise. And it took me a little bit to realize that they, by anti-clockwise, they meant counterclockwise. You have to remember that this rule set is made in England, and apparently in England, they don't say counterclockwise, they say anti-clockwise. It was new to me, but it was a learning lesson, and it didn't really disrupt things at all. You know, it just took a few moments for me to be like, wait a sec, that's not counterclockwise, but I think they mean counterclockwise because what else could it be? And so, you know, when you're moving 1 point or 2 points or whatever, he would just basically click the compass, so to speak, you know, to the right or the left or whatever was necessary. At one point during the game, when the weather was rolled for, there was a change. And the change in the weather caused the wind to sufficiently alter so that movement was reduced by 2 inches. Like I said, in the normal game, you use centimeters, so it would be 2 centimeters. But for us, we were using inches. So I had my John Paul Jones, which was like a 14-inch movement vessel, and I was moving it all over the place and turning and everything. It was fantastic. But then I could only move 12 inches. And that was kind of a problem for the British because they had to come, they had the wind at their back for most of the game, and they had to, you know, come to us. And there was this little narrow bottleneck. One side is a fort, and then my ships were right next to it, and I was trying to come out and do a little bit of battle with them. Now, when you move your ships, you, depending on the type of ship, impacts how you can turn. So, like, a larger vessel can do what they call a shallow turn. And there's these little turn gauges. And what you do is you put it against the ship, basically, so that it's flat. And then there'll be a gap between one end of the turn gauge and your ship. And all you do is you turn the ship towards that gap so that it touches the turning mechanism. And then that's your shallow turn. So these larger ships, they can do 2 shallow turns during the course of their movement phase. But they can't do them together. So when you move your ship, you have to move at least 2 inches first, because that's the inertia of the ship, continuing from before. Then you could do a turn if you want. Then you have to move another 2 inches before, or you can do another turn. I had the most of 2 turns for those larger vessels. For a smaller ship like my John Paul Jones, not only could I do an unlimited number of turns in my movement phase, but I got to do a sharper turn so that when I was moving, I could zigzag all over the place. Now, there's something you need to be aware of when you're moving your ships. This is during the age of sail, so if you're going into the wind, you might be in irons, and depending on a roll of a dice, you could cause damage to your ship, which eventually happened to me. I rolled really well for most of the game, and I didn't have any damage, but eventually I did, and I took some damage to my foremast, I think it was, on one of my ships. When you're in irons, whether you succeed or don't succeed that roll to determine whether you have damage to your ship, you immediately take a sharp turn. And that's before you move anywhere else. You can't, you know, move forward. You can't do anything else until you do that sharp turn. Now, this could come in handy with a larger vessel, because maybe you are going somewhere and you want to take a sharp turn, but a larger vessel can only do that shallow turn. If you go in and you want to take the chance of putting your ship in irons, where you could potentially take damage to your sails, you could do that, and you know, then you could take that sharp turn and just come to a new heading, and off you go. For those of you who are more in tune with Age of Sail naval combat, I know this is probably already known to all of you. And for those of you who are not, such as myself, I have more of an elementary sort of understanding of it, although I have a deep interest in it. It was really informative. Of course, the ships, they all had cannons on either side so that you could fire broadsides, no bow or stern chasers. So you really had to kind of cross the T, as it were. What I had done, I wanted to stop the British from coming in up towards the fort. So I had my larger ship, which had 10 carronades on it on each side. And I went out, and I anchored, and I basically blocked the way in. But those carronades, they only shoot 10 inches out, so that was not very far, considering how big the table was. Now, the John Paul Jones had light guns, which had a longer distance than the carronades. I could shoot out 20 inches. So I was trying to push that out, even though that was an objective. I was trying to push that out towards the open water so that I could cover further out. Our fort had one heavy cannon that could shoot 30 inches, and the rest were light, so they could go 20 inches. And we basically kind of had to wait for the British to come to us. Well, as the game played out, you got to keep in mind, we were vastly outnumbered by superior firepower from all these British vessels, and there was almost no way for us to make it out. So as they came bearing down on us, the John Paul Jones eventually lost its mast and couldn't move. And it could still shoot, but it couldn't move. It was in pristine order otherwise, but just it couldn't go anywhere. So it was just it was sitting there. And eventually it got overtaken and then captured and all its crew slaughtered, but did damage back to the invading crew members from the British Navy. Then the larger vessel weighed anchor and tried to maneuver about and inflicted some damage onto the British. But again, due to superior numbers, it eventually struck a hit to its rudder so that it could only go straight. And in due course, it suffered extreme damage. Our fort did a fantastic job. It sunk one of those British vessels, which I know our superiors in the Continental Navy were very pleased by because, you know, it's not easy to do. Unfortunately, I don't know what it was, but the British gunners were, like, practicing all day long for the few days before the battle, and they just, like, zeroed in on that fort, wiped out the whole contingent of gunners, so it was completely decrewed. They were able to take control of the fort, and that was game. At the end of the game, the British were they were hurt pretty badly. There were two or three ships that had significant damage done to them. I think only one ship was unscathed, and the rest were one was sunk, and then the rest had slight damage to it. They had recaptured the John Paul Jones, but I think I had sunk it actually. I wanted to deny the British getting it back. So I poured as much fire into that thing as I could with my larger vessel. Adrian was one of the British players, and then Adam, who runs a fantastic gaming blog, and I'll have a link to his blog in our show notes, was the other British player. Fantastic guy, a lot of fun to play with. Adam, it was great to finally meet you because, you know, I've seen your emails on the Black Powder New England mailing list, and it's just, it's a blast to see what you have to say about all sorts of Black Powder-related items. And the Trafalgar rule set fits with Black Powder, so that was also really cool. Good chance to get out and meet some new people. Now, at the end of the game, Americans lost, but do you know what? It didn't matter, because we had a ton of fun. And that's what really counts, for me anyway, is, you know, you go out and you're having a blast playing the games that you're playing. So, mission accomplished. Now, my thoughts on Trafalgar. By maybe turn 3, maybe turn 4 perhaps, about halfway through anyway, starting to pick up on the rules. And Rich had given us, you know, these quick reference guides, which I like a lot. They have those in the Black Powder rulebook, and I know other games have them. You know, you can just print it out, photocopy whatever, and you give it to the players and they can look. And it covers the things that are most commonly used. Covers your turn sequence, so you know, oh, first I do this, and then I do that, and then I do this, and so forth. And that helped a lot. Rich was there to answer questions that we had. We did have questions, of course. I mean, for most of us, I think it was our first time playing. I think Adrian had played maybe before, and I know he has the rules. But the rest of us, I think it was our first time playing. And, you know, we kind of picking it up. Now, this, of course, is a war game, so you had to think. And I felt like I was kind of thrown into the deep end because it was my first time doing anything like this and I didn't really want to, you know, screw up. At the same time, I felt like the battle would have been very difficult for us to win. Now, at the end of it, Rich had told us how it historically had went. And it turned out that we had done some of the things that were done historically. So that was kind of cool. Now, in retrospect, I think that I would like to have kept my John Paul Jones further back, so that the British would have had to go through the fort first, and then through my larger ship, and then get to the John Paul Jones, because, you know, the two objectives were the fort and to recapture the ship. I made it kind of easy for them by bringing it out, but I was hoping to, you know, go out and circle around and come back in, because this ship was more maneuverable, and it was faster. It could move 14 inches a turn, and I was trying to do my thing and go. Ultimately, I had to keep in mind that wind played an important role in this, as it did in actual battles during the Age of Sail. If you just go into the wind, you're not going to be doing much maneuvering. You're kind of stalled out, and you need to tack and come to a new heading so that you have the wind flowing into your sails to help propel you forward. They didn't have engines, no steam turbines or anything going on. It's not like the World War II naval wargaming that I do with, War at Sea, where, you can kind of go here and there, whatever, because you got your engines going. You're using your steam to propel you forward, and you don't care what way the wind's going. But back in 1812, you did, and it made a huge difference to your tactics. It made a huge difference to the strategy for the overall warfare, and it also made a big difference for how effective you could be. One change in the weather made a huge difference to what you could or could not do. So it was a very good learning experience for me to do that. I had an interesting plan. My compatriot, Alan, had an interesting plan. And so did the British. Adrian and Adam both had good plans. It all just kind of came down to, what's the weather going to do? What can we do? And how quickly can we react to the changing situation? Of course, we ended up losing as Americans, and the British ended up winning. But like I said, at the end of the day, we had a lot of fun, and that's all that matters. So that was Friday night's game. And then Saturday, like I had said, I had a game that I was scheduled for. It was Battle of Wurttemberg. I actually had to cancel out of that. I sent a text message to Adrian to let Rich know that someone else could take my place. My wife and I, like I said, were up in Portland also to celebrate our anniversary. And so we spent the day in Old Port. We went to the Spring Point Ledge Lighthouse, and we just did some stuff. Then we went out to eat and shopped, and I mean, it was a fantastic day out. And we weren't able to get back in time for me to play the game, which was okay. I felt bad, having registered for it and then not been able to play in it. But when we came back, the game was still going on because the game didn't end until 6. So I was able to see that it was full up. There was, I think, almost a dozen people playing, and they all looked like they were having a blast. So that was really cool. Then after we had come back, we went back out. We went out for dinner at this place that I highly recommend, should you ever go to Portland or if you ever intend to go to Huzzah, that you really need to think about going to. And it's this kind of like local, I'm not really sure whether, local kind of pub sort of thing. And they have all sorts of locally brewed beer, and they have fantastic locally grown ingredients that they put into their food. It's a lot of fun, and it's called the Great Lost Bear. It's in Portland, actually on the outskirts of Portland. But the food was fantastic. They had all sorts of stuff that you could pick from. If you're a vegetarian or a vegan, they could adapt things to that. They actually had a whole vegetarian menu. If you're on a diet, they could change things to fit those needs. Or if you just wanted whatever you wanted, they could do that as well. So while we were looking at the menu, and it's quite a menu to look at, I was trying to make up my mind, and my wife came across something called the Almighty Cheeses Burger, which sent us into fits of laughter because we're fans of the TV show Glee, and there was an episode called Cheeses, and they dealt with religion, whether or not they believed in Jesus, because it was a grilled cheese that someone had with the image, supposedly, of Jesus Christ on it. And so that just kind of sent us into laughter, and I was actually thinking of getting a portobello mushroom burger. My wife was like, that might be funny if you get the Almighty Cheeses Burger. And I was like, hey, why not? So this thing came, and I'm going to have a picture of this up so you can see. And what it is it's a grilled cheese sandwich with pickles in it. And then there's a burger without the bun. And then below that is another grilled cheese sandwich. Yes, I know, heart attack waiting to happen. So they brought it, and the burger actually wasn't cooked as much as I would have liked, so I sent it back, and unfortunately they had to remake the whole thing, and I felt bad about that, but when it came back, it was so good. I cut it in half, and I was having it, and it was really good. The burger was good, the grilled cheese was great. I think I like the grilled cheese better than the burger, but it was really good food. And then to go with that, of course, since they had all sorts of local brews, I thought, I got to try something, and I looked on their on-tap list, and they had Hefeweizen. I'm a big fan of Hefeweizen, so they had one put up by Widmore, and that's a brewery in Maine, so I thought, hey, why not? So I had a Widmore Hefeweizen. It was a really good beer, and it was just a really good time out, and we made plenty of time back so I could go and play in the Conquest of Hanghai. Now, if you're a clock watcher, you're noticing that we're about halfway through the show, which is good because I was hoping to cover both battles in one whole hour episode without having to go into another show, but we'll see how things happen. So The Conquest of Hankai is a game run by Mike Payne, and Mike has run this for, well, more years than I know about. And what's really cool about this is that he has it set up so that kids can play in it. And if you go and you look at the event listing, which by the time you listen to this, you might not be able to, but I'm going to have a link up to it. Hopefully they'll still have it up so that you can see. Mike words things because he wants people to realize that what he's doing is it's a game for kids and for people who like to play with kids. So his description for it is that Conquest of Hankai, it's 1920s China, kind of pulp, sort of historical, sort of based, but more pulp minis game. And his description is, E.P. Singh and E.T. Singh, the notorious Singh brothers, have arrived at Hankai Harbor aboard the tramp steamer Macedonia. Detectives for the Singapore police with a group of Singapore constables in tow, they are searching for smuggled Chinese artifacts. While racing against time, they are faced with hair-raising conflict, sensational adventure, and treacherous challenges. As a madman vents his fury on the world, dare death at the hands of the mysterious Dr. Satan and his merciless minions, you'll gasp at the breathtaking suspense. Who will stop this maniac and his diabolical steam robots? Will it be the Rocketeer, the Invisible Man, or will it be you? Beginners strongly encouraged. Kids are welcome, and adults that can play like kids are welcome too. So this game, Mike had said that he could take 9 people, but I think he had 10 or 11 by the time he was done, and at least half of them were kids, which is, it's fantastic. Last year, I didn't get to play in this. I played in a derivative that he had run, where it was more naval combat. There was Spanish colonists, and they, you know, were in this monastery kind of encampment sort of thing, and there were Filipino pirates coming and wanted to take them captive. But this, you played as a different character, and you had this warband, so to speak. And so I was Alan Quartermain, and I had, you know, this hulking Chinese kind of guy. I think it was a Ogre Kingdom's model, actually, and this woman. And I had to go, and I had to collect Chinese artifacts, and all the other players had different people that they were trying to be. There was like the diabolical Fu Manchu, the mysterious Dr. Satan, and a bunch of different people. And we had to go and collect artifacts. And at the end of the game, whoever had the most artifacts won. Now, in the process of it, what's really cool is that Mike's table, and it's huge, and I'm going to have pictures up of this as well, was partly water and partly land. And on the land and on the islands in the harbor, there were, you know, crates and barrels and stuff, and underneath them had letters that corresponded to different resources. If you had 2 of a resource, you could sell them to Mike, who in-game was like a trader, and sell them to him, and you got 15 coins. But if it was something that you were looking for, like my character was looking for gunpowder, so if I had 2 containers with the letters on them that corresponded to gunpowder, I could trade them in, and I would get 30 coins. Now, what would you use these coins for? Well, you could buy a guy for 10 coins. And the reason why you needed guys is because when you found these containers, you spent a free action to, you know, look at it, and then you could take the container if you want or leave it. But if you took it, you had to have a person carry it. So if you only had 2 guys and they each had a container and you found a 3rd container, you couldn't take it unless you dropped your container or unless you had another guy. So you could spend 10 coins, 10 mechs in the game, 10 coins to buy a guy, and you could have up to 10 additional guys that you purchase this way. Or you could spend 30 mechs, 30 coins, to buy an artifact card. So Mike had these different decks. He had a black deck and a bunch of yellow decks, and the black decks were artifacts. And basically he just used, you know, simple playing cards. And he had put words on them. Like, there might be one like Hades, the Helm of Hades, I think is one I had. And you could either use that in game, or you could keep it, and it counted towards one of your artifacts at the end of the game. But if you used it in game, it didn't count because you had used it and done something with it. Now, you could do just about anything you wanted. You come up with what you wanted to do with the artifact or in the game at all, anything you wanted to do. And you would say to Mike, oh, can I do whatever, this, this, and this? And he'd say yes, no, or he might say roll a dice. Now, Mike likes to use D10s, and I think it's because the probability of them is a little bit better than a D6. Because a D6, each pip is almost 20%. On a D10, Mike says zeros are zeros, they're not tens. And then you have 1 through 9. So he'd have you roll a D10, and depending on what you rolled, he'd make up a decision at the point that you did that, and then let you know whether you succeeded or failed. As you can tell, this is a very old-school way to play, but also a really fun way to play. The kids really get into it. Who am I kidding? I really get into it. I get really excited about Mike's games. So, you know, we had one point during the game, there was one of the kids who played last year in the game I played in, and he was playing with, I think, one of his brothers, actually, and they had a whole stack of artifact cards, and they were using them together to create a dragon. I guess they had, like, dragon bones and some other stuff, and his brother turned out it was a wizard. So they used their magic, and they made a dragon. They had a dragon going around with them, which was really cool. And during the game, one of the other players who was, he was either E.P. Singh or E.T. Singh. I can't remember which one, but he was one of the Singh brothers. They got into a battle where they had these other artifact cards, and they wanted to steal, take control of the dragon. So, you know, they were popping down these cards to try to take control of the dragon. And then the kid and his brother, who had the dragon, they were popping other cards down to try to counter that. Now, in addition to getting your artifact cards and other resources in the game, you started off the game with gold coins, 2 gold coins. And you could use them for just about anything you wanted. But because they were so rare, you really wanted to save them for special things. Like, at one point, my character, Alan Quatermain, was going to be taken captive. So I used one to undo that. It's like a mulligan, a reset. And so the kids had artifacts that gave them extra gold coins. So they were plopping down gold coins to counter things that the Singh brothers were trying to do to take the dragon. And eventually, they popped down tons of coins. And they ended up succeeding in countering what the Singh brothers were doing. So they held on to the dragon. And that was near the end of the game. It was really, really exciting. So the game, you know, went through, and you could do, like I said, anything. At one point, I took control of a Chinese junk, and I was sailing around shooting ships and all sorts of stuff, and collecting things, and I was having a blast. And one of the things I discovered was a whole crate of Chinese artifacts that counted as 4 artifacts for me at the end of the game. And I had to keep it a secret, because if other people knew, they would have came and attacked me and tried to take them away. So I had that, and I'm sailing around in the harbor and doing my thing, and everyone else is going off, and they're, you know, inspecting ships and inspecting houses, because if you succeeded, you might find an artifact. If you failed, you'd get a yellow card, which could be good or could be bad. One of the bad ones was, like, lose 2 turns, or you get captured, and all sorts of different things. So they're inspecting that. Some of the kids turned these big Chinese statues into stone golems, and they were going around, and it was really cool. And then one of the guys who was playing the mysterious Dr. Satan ended up having a character that he had taken control of, Nellie Bly, who went around and interviewed you. And if she interviewed your character had to stop immediately, lost their turn, and then Nellie Bly got, I think it was like 15 or 25 max. So basically, he just got extra money, and you couldn't do anything. So you wanted to stay away from her. Well, the game progressed and got to the end because we ran out of time. And I think we could have played for hours and hours and hours because the kids were having a lot of fun. I was having a blast. I think everyone else was. And, you know, just going around and collecting stuff and doing things. And it came time to see who won. So the kids with the dragon, who had the stack of cards, it looked like they were going to win. They had something like, I think, 11 artifacts. But then the Singh brothers, it turned out they had 13. No, I was counting up what I had, and I had 5 artifacts, but then you got points, like artifact points, so to speak, for your resources you had. If you had, you know, like the most number of a single one of them, or stuff like that, or the most number that you were looking for. So I ended up with 11 artifacts. But then there was one kid named Jonathan. There was actually 2 other people with my name. One was the guy who played as the mysterious Dr. Satan, and one was this younger kid. His dad played in the game, and his brother was one of the kids who had the dragon. And he was really excited during the game. Like, when it would be his turn, he'd jump up and he'd go, yay! And he was really into it. And he made the game a blast. Like, just his excitement and enthusiasm and his energy, it was invigorating, really. It kept you going, even though there was a, you know, we were playing after 10 o'clock. I think the game ended at, like, 11, 11:30. And, you know, he was still going strong. So at the end of the game, counted up all his stuff, and he had the most number of resources and this and that. And it turned out he ended up winning. He came from behind like a dark horse. No one expected it. And then he came in, and he stole victory, and he won. And it was just a really fantastic game. After the game, got to hang out with Mike a little bit. And, you know, we were chatting about things. Mike, I always love seeing you. I love playing in your games. It's wonderful. So that was Conquest of Pengai. That was all the games that I played in, because Sunday, you know, had to leave and get back here. But there were games Sunday morning. I took some pictures of some games. And then we headed on back after a weekend up in Portland, Maine, playing games at Huzzah 2012. Now, I've been talking about the games at Huzzah, and I haven't really talked about the other stuff. I want to talk a little bit about the vendors. I was a little disappointed this year in the vendors. There were more vendors this year than there were the year before, which I really enjoyed. I liked seeing that there were more people. I liked seeing that people brought different things. I stopped over at the Adler Hobby booth, said hi to Gordon and Denise, and they had all sorts of stuff. It's fantastic. They've always bring lots of Flames of War things. And Gordon was running a Flames of War tournament, which was well attended. And I'm told people had a lot of fun. Adam, who I mentioned earlier in the show, who played in the first battle of Sackett's Harbor, he was in the tournament, and he won the Sportsmanship Award, which I think is probably the best award you can win, because to me that says, you know what, you're a fun guy, a fun person. You don't have to be a guy. A fun person to be playing a game with, that people had a lot of fun there, that they had a good time with you, and that you weren't being a jerk about things. If someone's a jerk, I don't want to play a game with them, because I'm not going to have fun. I want to have a good time playing the games, because you know what, it's a game. And if you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. So I think it's fantastic that he won the Sportsmanship Award. And, you know, bravo, Adam. Well done. I can't wait to play some Black Powder with you. I'm looking forward to that. And we'll have to set up a time sometime. So Gordon, like I said, was running the tournament. And he had a well-stocked booth. And I saw some stuff I liked. I thought about getting the Trafalgar rulebook. But I think it was like $42. And I didn't really want to spend $42 on the rulebook. Mainly because I'm not going to be playing it just yet. I don't know if I'm going to go ahead and use Trafalgar to handle naval battles in the Deadhampton Revolution, or if I'm going to do something different. Maybe I'll use a method like Mike used with Conquest of Pengai and have playing cards with things written on them and, you know, just draw from a deck, and that'll determine if there's an encounter and what happens with it or whatever. I could do that. It might be easier than, you know, getting a whole rule set, learning the rules, painting models and stuff. But, I mean, it wouldn't be as cool as be like, come on guys, we got an engagement, let's get together, and, you know, get together with Adrian and Court and whoever else is going to be playing in Deadhampton Revolution and put our ships on the table and fight it out and see what really happens. That would definitely be more exciting and cooler to look at. I mean, it would have some cool pictures, and I could do some cool blog write-ups and talk here on the show about that, whereas with the deck of cards or whatever I do, if I resolve the battles another way, it's just like, oh, we resolved the battles, moving on. So I'm not really sure which way I want to do, so I didn't want to spend the $42 on the book. And I looked around. There were a lot of other vendors. The Eureka Miniatures guys were there, and they always have some really cool stuff. But I was disappointed because they have a whole line of American War of Independence, American Rev sort of stuff. And I didn't see any of it at the con. And I know you can only bring so many things to a convention with you, because you only have so much room and so much space at the con to display your wares, and I understand that. But at the same time, I was thinking, well, you know, this is a whole new thing that they had been pushing out not too long ago, and I really thought that maybe they were going to go ahead and just kind of bring them, because they were like, I don't know, they had released them last year, and I thought they were relatively new, that they'd want to push them. It's the whole ragged line of Continental Infantry, and they have like dragoons and stuff. Basically, they wear like distressed uniforms and all that sort of stuff. And they made them so that they fit in with the Perry miniatures. So they're 28 mil. They have them so that they're you know, the same height. They're kind of like the same width. They're, you know, as stocky or lean as the case might be. And they fit in with the Perry miniatures models. They're relatively new. And I thought, you know, they'd have them. And I was actually going to buy some to put in with my 28 mil AWI stuff. But they didn't have any. So I was disappointed by that. And then I went over to, I wish I could remember the vendor's name. I hate to say it, I'm sorry, but these carry Architects of War stuff. And they had, you know, other things there this time, but they didn't have any Architects of War terrain. And I was looking forward to that because I was going to pick up some pieces. Last year I picked up some, and I put together some of it, and I'm working on it. I thought, oh, you know, I'll get some more because it's cool 28 mil stuff. I could use it either for, depending on what they had, either for AWI, I could use it for a Saga, or whatever. Not a thing. I checked out some of the book vendors, which is cool because I saw some original pieces written by like Donald Featherstone or Charles Grant. They actually had one book that was signed by Featherstone, but I think it was like $70, and I wasn't paying $70 for it, but it was really cool. And then I meandered over to the Hobby Bunker booth, and they have a huge section because they always bring a lot of stuff. I usually find a lot of things there that I like. And I found some stuff they had, you know, the new Dystopian Wars rulebook. But what I was really hoping for was to get maybe some Saga stuff, or they usually bring a bunch of JR miniatures terrain. So they had some, and I was looking through, and they had, you know, some 15 mil Civil War stuff. I thought maybe I could get a couple pieces for that because we've been doing ACW. Court has a bunch of 15 mil ACW models all done up that we've been using. We used them when we ran the event at TotalCon, and we used them for the Seaward March one-day campaign that I did. And so they had like that kind of stuff, but they didn't have any AWI, which was weird because last year they had their 25 mil AWI buildings. And then when I was at Havoc, they had some of that there too, and they actually had stuff left over. I picked up, you know, a piece, and I was hoping to get more, but they didn't have any, so I was kind of disappointed. I was looking around, and I was like, I could get some, you know, something else maybe, but I felt like I was just going to be buying to buy, so I was disappointed at the lack of stuff that they had that I wanted. Now, the plus side of this is that the convention does raffles. They do two raffles, and they did it last year, and they did it again this year. So they did one raffle that they did off on Saturday at 7:30, I think, and another one that they did Sunday at like noon. And there was a lot of cool stuff in the raffles. They had some Architects of War buildings, and one of the things that they had I really wanted was the garden. It sells for $30, so what I did was I bought $20 of tickets, raffle tickets, and if you spent $5 for raffle tickets, you got 10 raffle tickets, so you could guess how many raffle tickets I got by spending $20. I put them all in on the Architects of War thing, and wouldn't you know it, I didn't get it. I was a little disappointed, but, you know, that's what happens with the raffle. It seemed like it was a fairly popular thing for people to put in for, and I thought maybe I had at least half the tickets, thought I had good chances. But you just never know. I did notice that our friends over at War Games Soldiers and Strategy, the publishers behind them, had put out, and maybe it was the people over at WSNS themselves who went ahead and was able to push it through, but there was a one-year digital subscription to WSNS that was up. There was a same thing for Medieval Warfare and Ancient Warfare, so it was really cool to see those there. I love WSNS. I love the Ancient Warfare podcast, so I was really happy and appreciative to see that they're supporting local gaming here in New England by providing these as prizes for the convention to raffle off. So that was really cool. I also noticed when I was over in the Hobby Bunker booth that they had a copy of issue 28, I think it is, of Battle Games Magazine in physical form. So it was really cool to see how big it was and the glossy pictures and everything. And while I was at the convention, I noticed a guy, and I should have stopped and got his name, and I didn't, but a guy wearing a Battle Games t-shirt. Now, Henry, if you're listening to this, I didn't know you had t-shirts. How do I get one? He was wearing, it was like one of those baseball t-shirts. It was, you know, white, with the Battle Games logo and all that sort of stuff on it. And then the baseball, like, t-shirt, you know, on the sleeves and around the neck, it was blue. It was really cool. and I'd love to get one. Now that Atlantic owns Battle Games, I don't know if that's a possibility anymore, if they're going to be doing that sort of stuff or what it is. But if they are, put me down for one. I definitely would wear one of those. And speaking of t-shirts, the convention this year, their theme was Middle Eastern, as it were. It was Boxer Rebellion, I think. Not Middle Eastern, I'm sorry. Far Eastern, Boxer Rebellion. So their t-shirt this year was a white t-shirt, whereas last year was gray, and I think I like the gray better. But it was a white t-shirt, and on the front, the artwork was from Osprey Publishing. So I'm sure Osprey donated that. It's really nice, and it was from one of the books, I would imagine, on the Boxer Rebellion. A bunch of people, boxers, I'm guessing, dressed up. And then, of course, on the back of the t-shirt, the big logo for Shipyard Ale, because Shipyard sponsors Huzzah. So I want to give a big thank you to Huzzah for a fantastic convention and for a Shipyard for sponsoring Huzzah. So, like I said, it was a great convention. I had a blast, but I was slightly disappointed with the vendors. And, you know, that's not their fault. It was just what I was looking for they didn't have, but I was hopeful to find something. And whereas I didn't, I put, you know, money in for the raffles, which I proceeded to lose, but that's okay. You never know what's going to happen when you put in for a raffle. And sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And that's just the way the game goes. So this year, Huzzah was another huge success. I know it was well attended. I had a blast. I can't wait to go back again. And I look forward to continuing to attend Huzzah for as long as I'm able to. I had a lot of fun playing in the first Battle of Sackett's Harbor, run by Rich Clayton. And had a blast playing with Alan and Adrian and Adam. They're great guys to play with. I had a ton of fun playing in Conquest of Hengai. It's a nice change-up where it was more of a, you know, old-school kind of game instead of, like, the deep wargaming of, like, Sackett's Harbor and some of the other games. So it was really cool, and Mike Payne runs a fantastic event. If you ever get a chance to play in anything he's running, I highly recommend signing up for it. You know, he runs at Havoc, and I think Council of Five Nations runs a con, and he does things there and stuff, so it's a lot of fun. And anything that the Boston Trained Bands runs, I highly recommend. Rich is fantastic. Burgie is fantastic. They're all amazing. Just wonderful guys, very friendly, very understanding, and they run a good game. So if you ever see Boston Train Band listed as people running an event, please sign up for it. And also if you see Mike Payne listed as running an event, sign up for it. So thank you for listening. This has been an hour-long show, roughly. And I had a blast at Huzzah, as always. It was fantastic. So thank you to everyone who made Huzzah a huge success. And I know that next year will be also cool. And one other thing, just to mention briefly, as the new year had rolled around, I did my, you know, unrealistic goals for 2012, and one of them was to go to more conventions than I had gone to before last year. And I said I wanted to go to 3 conventions this year. Well, I made it to TotalCon, I made it to Havoc, and I made it to Huzzah. So big check mark on that. And I love being able to talk about the events with you guys. I hope you enjoyed listening to them. Of course, the show notes will have links to Huzzah, it'll have links to vendors, it'll have links to whatever I talked about on the show that I can give you a link to. So I'm going to go ahead and link to Adrian has a blog, New England Grognard. He did a brief write-up about Huzzah. Adam has a blog that I'm going to link to. It's Fencing Frog. He's over at blogspot.com, so I'll have a link to that. And just links everywhere, and pictures and stuff. We actually have tons of pictures up on the Facebook page. So if you're a fan of us on Facebook, that would be the easiest way for you to see pictures. I will put some up on the blog. It takes a little bit of extra effort to get them up there, though. And Facebook just made it a little bit easier. So I will have a link to our Facebook page. I would highly recommend that if you're on Facebook, please like us. We're at 92 plus likes right now, and I'd love for us to get to 100. So maybe you liking us and going on and seeing the pictures from Huzzah would be a great way to see the pictures and give us a like and promote us. So I want to thank you for your time, and I hope you enjoy the show, and I hope you enjoy all the stuff in the show notes that I've linked to. Don't forget, please, if you live in New England, support your local game stores. Try to go to the local cons. TotalCon will be in February. then there's Havoc, and then Huzzah, of course, in Maine. And if you're looking for magazines to go and read, I gotta recommend Battle Games. I gotta recommend WSNS. I both subscribe to them. I also love War Games Illustrated. They provided a prize for the convention as well, so it was really cool. Next time, we're gonna be talking about a bunch of other stuff. I wanna get into talking about the new Ranger Citadel paints. I have an update on Battle Games Magazine that I want to talk about, which I didn't have time for this time. I want to talk about that. There'll be more Dead Hampton Revolution, and I'm going to do a brief review next time, I believe next time, on 10 mil Old Glory miniatures, and just all that sort of stuff. So thank you, and as always, keep on gaming.